Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP monthly training series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Welcome, everyone. This is Edie Troutwine with the Children's Justice Project. Thank you for joining us today, November 8, 2018, for a Blog Talk presentation titled Family First Prevention and Services Act Overview. We are honored to have today's presenter here with us. Her name is Prudence Beidler Carr. She is an attorney and director of the American Bar Association Center on Children and the Law. She will provide an overview of the Family First Prevention and Services Act, also called FFPSA for short, and she will discuss some of its implications for the legal community. FFPSA was signed into law as part of the Bipartisan Budget Act on February 9th of 2018. For the first time, FFPSA provides federal Title IV-E funding to support children at risk of entering the child welfare system by permitting state reimbursement for mental health services, substance use treatment, and in-home parenting services that assist children, their parents, or kin. The legislation also establishes new limits on federal reimbursement for congregate care placements. Other changes resulting from FFPSA include enhancements under Title IV-B for family reunification services after a child has returned home, incentives for the adoption and legal guardianship payment program, and standardization of data exchange requirements among states and for federal reporting. Again, we're excited that you've chose to join us today. There are several handouts for today's presentation, and those can be found on the CJP website under the Blog Talk tab. There are three handouts. One is the PowerPoint presentation that will be used today. The other is a handout for the legal community on the FFPSA, and another is a summary of the legislation for attorney and judges. So with that, I will turn it over to Prudence.
Wonderful. Thank you, Edie. It's great to be on the call today, and I look forward to sharing some information about this new legislation and hopefully to answering a few questions that may come in at the end of the conversation. I've also included all of my contact information on the last slide of today's presentation so that if you have follow-up questions that you'd like to ask at a different time, you can feel free to reach out to me as well. And I'll start by just encouraging everyone to open up the PowerPoint if you can, because there's a lot of information in this federal law and makes it a little bit easier to follow along. And I will be basing today's conversation and presentation on the slides that are attached to the website. So the goals of today's presentation are to provide an overview of this new federal legislation, to identify and sort of walk through some of the components that are most relevant for legal practice, and then to discuss and highlight sort of some of the questions for the legal community. And when I refer to the legal community, I'm really talking about a broad interpretation of legal community. So attorneys in direct practice who represent child welfare agencies, who represent state governments, also attorneys who represent NGALs, who represent children and youth in practice, parents' counsel, as well as judges, court administrators, court improvement program directors, social workers who play a critical role as part of many legal teams, et cetera. And so the goal of today's conversation is really to highlight sort of some of the most relevant provisions, but also some of the questions that this legislation really introduces for different actors within the child welfare legal community. And on that note, it's a separate handout that I did want to just flag sort of before going into more details is one of the things that the ABA Center on Children and the Law has done is to try and sort of break down the different types of legal audience in different contexts for how to implement this new legislation in practice and what kinds of different roles attorneys, judges, court personnel, et cetera, will have in that process of implementation. So if you open the documents, it's focused on the heading is the legal community role in implementing the Family First Prevention Services Act. It highlights that this law, which was signed into, which became effective and was signed into law in 2018, has more than 20 different provisions. There are a couple of provisions that are more detailed than others, but overall there's a huge number of provisions and a lot of sort of variation in some of the provisions in this law. The ones that I've identified here in the categories 1 through 12 are the ones that are especially relevant to the legal community, and those are the ones that I'll try and highlight in most detail today. So that's the prevention services provision, residential family-based treatment, facility placements, kinship navigator programs, reunification services, interstate placement, regional partnership grants, model licensing standards, limitations on non-foster family home placements, qualified residential treatment programs, inappropriate diagnosis prevention, foster family recruitment and retention, and improvements to the JV foster care independence program. I won't go into detail on every single one of those 12, but those are the ones, again, that I really think have the most relevance for direct practice and for implementation from a legal perspective. And when thinking about sort of what that means and who are the actors within the legal community who will have a particularly important role in implementation of these many different provisions of the Family First Act, we've grouped those into three different categories. And my understanding on this call is that there are representatives from across Wyoming who really probably fall into each category. And so I'll take a moment to highlight those as well. The first is legal issues in implementing the law on a state and local level. And so what we mean here is the legal audience that really includes state legislators, attorneys for state governments, governor's offices, attorney general's offices, child welfare agency attorneys, and other government offices that are really responsible for implementing federal law and understanding the implications of interpreting and providing state guidance on how to apply key provisions in this new law, such as the prevention services provisions, the model licensing standards, and the foster family home and the qualified residential treatment program provisions. Those all have a lot of implications at the state level that will be really important for, again, sort of the attorneys who are advising governor's offices, legislature, et cetera, to be at the table and providing sort of a macro perspective on. The second category of legal issues is really relevant to direct practice. And so this is sort of looking at a number of the different parts of the Family First Act as tools for advocacy and tools for decision-making in individual cases. And so when we think about this legal audience, we're really talking about attorneys who represent children and youth, attorneys who represent agencies, and attorneys who represent parents in child welfare cases, as well as attorneys and advocates for kin and other foster parent caregivers who may be involved in the legal proceedings. So an example is that an attorney or advocate's role in direct representation can be improved by understanding some of the implications and the application of some of these new provisions in federal law, including the residential treatment facility placement options, which I'll talk about in more detail in a moment, the extended reunification services funding options, which I'll also go into in more detail, the model licensing standards, the qualified residential treatment program assessment process, and then the inappropriate diagnosis provisions and the CHAFE extensions. So all of those are ones that may have a significant impact on individual cases, and so it's important for attorneys to know kind of how these new provisions may affect case decisions and case outcomes and may impact your own advocacy in the courtroom and outside. And then the final category is the one that's probably the most specific and the most obvious within the actual statutory text of the Family First Act, and this is court hearings and judicial responsibilities. So there are very specific responsibilities that are spelled out with respect to the provisions of the Family First Act that limit federal reimbursement for group home placements. And so this legal audience includes judges who handle child welfare cases, court administrators, court improvement program offices, who are responsible for providing training on some of these new provisions, and then also includes especially child welfare agency attorneys who will have increased responsibilities for providing evidence to support group home placements. So that's kind of the very broad overview of how we at the ABA Center on Children's Law have been trying to take a very complex piece of legislation and sort of put it into a couple of different chunks or different focus areas as we think of how to implement it through partnership with the legal community. I'll take a step back into the slideshow and take a step back as well and just give a little bit of context on sort of why the ABA Center on Children and the Law is doing this work. I know many of you have already collaborated in years past with the ABA Center on Children and the Law and know our work well. I know we've had a couple of projects in the past in Wyoming and have a number of staff attorneys who have done these blog presentations on previous topics as well. So the ABA, as everyone knows, is an association of attorneys and legal professionals, and within the larger association, there's a number of different entities that have substantive legal experts who work on specific areas of law, and we have, at the Center on Children and the Law, a staff of about 15 attorneys who, almost all of whom came from direct practice in child welfare proceedings and now work on a really wide variety of programs and projects, all of which are focused on improving legal representation for all of the parties in child welfare proceedings and improving the legal systems that impact children and families' lives. One of the themes of a lot of the work that we do is really connecting child welfare and other legal topics, so looking at kind of the intersections of different areas of law. And another theme of what we do is to really take often the information that comes from new federal legislation and help to disseminate that and make that more accessible in partnership with state and local governments and entities. And so that's why this was a good opportunity. I've been doing a number of these presentations on the Family First Prevention Services Act throughout the country recently and really focusing on trying to reach the audience of attorneys and social workers and judges who are going to have a very important role in implementation. Again, as I mentioned, you can find my contact information for any follow-up that you may want at the end of the slides, and then also this is our website here at the bottom of slide number two. So the Family First Prevention Services Act, an overview of the act is that it is federal child welfare legislation, signed into law, as I've mentioned before, in February of 2018, and it has the potential to have a very significant impact on children and families across the country. That's the goal. The focus is on investing in prevention and family services that support parents, children, and kin. The part of the new legislation extends reunification services. It limits placements that are not in a foster family home, so placements that are in a group home environment. The Act seeks to ensure the quality of residential treatment when group home placements are necessary. And it provides modifications and extensions to the CHAFE Foster Care and Dependence Program. There are also modifications and reauthorization of certain Title IV-B provisions, including the Court Improvement Program was reauthorized for an additional 5 years. All three components of the court improvement program were reauthorized as part of the Family First Prevention Services Act. So that slide has a lot of information and sort of a very sweeping approach to describing the Family First Prevention Services Act. If you flip to slide number 4, this is the one I like better, which is essentially what this act is in a nutshell. So the two major themes, and I will try to echo back to these themes as I go into detail about some of the provisions that I think are most important to those of you on this call, but the two really, really important themes that come out are putting families first. The title of the law says what it intends to do. So throughout many different provisions, the goal is to put the concept of family first, and so that means really trying to support children's connection to biological family or to the parents with whom there may be challenges that require additional services but don't require foster care placement. There's also a lot in this act focused on when children can't be with their parents or their immediate families being with kin and relative placements. And then there's also a lot on the importance of foster parents and foster families as an alternative to any kind of group home. And so those are sort of three themes that really tie in with this concept of putting family first. So family meaning biological family, kin, extended kin, fictive kin, and foster parents and foster families. Those are a couple of examples of how that theme comes out. And then the second theme is, I call it the show me the money theme. And this is really that so much of this legislation is about shifting the way that resources are allocated in child welfare to try and undo things that have been perceived as sort of maybe resulting in unintended consequences in the past, so shifting the way that resources are allocated on the front end of a case, and then also providing new restrictions on how federal funding can be used for reimbursement in certain situations that the federal government would like to discourage. And so very much related to implementation side of this legislation is that there's a lot of potential dollars sort of at stake and a lot of potential dollars that are intended to shape the way that this law is implemented. For the legal community, I think there's a fantastic opportunity to shape implementation. And the sort of overarching question that I'll introduce before going into so many of the more specific provisions is just to really throw out there the same question that I think every audience that I've met with so far is wrestling with, which is the intention of this law is to, to support families and to ensure that children are in the best possible care. And how do we make sure that that is what the law accomplishes? And sort of where will we be in 10 years? What have we learned from past significant changes in child welfare legislation? What have been some of the successes of implementing things that had high hopes, and what have been some of the lessons learned? And at this sort of inception point of beginning to think about implementation of this new legislation, what are the things that we as lawyers and as the legal community can really be thoughtful about and can try and put in place in our individual states and in our individual jurisdictions to make sure that this law succeeds in accomplishing the goals that it sets out to do and doesn't have unintended consequences. The timelines, the law has a lot of varied implementation timelines, and some of the changes are already effective as of the beginning of this federal fiscal year, which started October 1st. So I've broken it into three parts. The first part is to talk about the key services provisions. So these are services that are supposed to be in place to either limit the need for foster care or enhance the ability of a child to remain connected to family, either kin or biological parents when possible, even if a child is placed in foster care. So the prevention services provision, the short summary is that this is the first time that federal funding has ever been available to support services that are specifically intended to prevent children's placement in foster care. This is a really big deal. So previously, federal funding has been really limited and targeted to providing for, as you all know, the maintenance payments once a child has already officially entered foster care. And the goal here is to use that same source of funding, but to open it up for supporting a child or supporting family members in order to prevent a need to have the child enter into foster care. So I'm going to talk in more detail about a couple of the different sort of aspects of this prevention service provision. The first is who are the eligible children and parents. The second is what are the eligible services and programs. And the third is what are the state requirements in order to obtain this new, it's not necessarily a new source of funding, but it is new opportunities for supporting state costs and state services. So what are the state requirements to obtain this new federal reimbursement? Again, remember the themes throughout that the goal is really to put family first, and the tool that the government is using is its own federal support for child welfare as in the form of dollars to try and create shifts in the way that some of the system operates. Eligible children and parents. So there's a term called candidates for foster care. These prevention services are available to support children and their family members when a child is considered to be a candidate for foster care. These prevention services can also be used for pregnant and parenting youth who are in foster care already themselves. And the idea there is that their own child or the child who they will give birth to soon may themselves be a candidate for foster care. And then the services can also support not just services that go to the child or to the parenting or pregnant youth, but also services that support birth parents, adoptive parents, relative and non-relative guardians of candidates for foster care. So candidate for foster care, and I highlighted here, and I've tried to do that throughout with the different slides, the sort of potential attorney role. What we're talking about in this context would really be before any kind of petition has been filed, and so the more traditional attorney role of being engaged and appointed to a case would not necessarily take hold, except for a couple of situations. But going back to that overview that I gave at the beginning of this call, I do think that there's a huge role when thinking about the potential of your state taking prevention services as a reimbursement option. There is a huge role for attorneys and judges and court personnel and social workers to be at the table providing guidance on how this might play out in practice. And so that is certainly an important attorney role right now. The candidate for foster care, the definition that's provided in the legislation is a candidate for foster care as a child at serious risk of removal, as evidenced by the state agency either pursuing his or her removal from home or making reasonable efforts to prevent removal. The federal government, the Department of Health and Human Services, Children's Bureau has indicated that they will not be issuing any more guidance on how to define the term candidate for foster care beyond what's already in this legislation. Many states across the country already do have their own interpretations of this term and their own applications of this term. Forgive me that I don't know what Wyoming's might be, but we have a goal at the ABA of trying to compile a number of the different already existing state approaches to defining this term to make that available and accessible to different states that are trying to interpret how they may want to apply it and use it in practice in their jurisdictions. So documentation, a state must document that it has determined a child is a candidate for foster care through one of three methods. Either the case plan identifies foster care as the goal, absent prevention services, or an eligibility form is used to document the child's eligibility for Title IV-E, or there's evidence of court proceedings that's related to the child's removal that would indicate that the child is a candidate for care. Now that's a little bit confusing because I've already said most of these situations arise pre-petition and so wouldn't involve appointed counsel yet. I think that this category is most likely to come up in relation to some of the next provision, which is the aftercare portion, which is that it is possible for a child who is reunified, adopted or placed with a legal guardian or transferred to a relative when exiting foster care, it is possible for that child to be considered a candidate if there's a chance of the child's reentry into foster care that the agency has flagged and is concerned about. And so that kind of circumstance would be that the evidence of the court proceedings related to the child's removal would then also correlate with the agency identifying the child as a candidate for foster care as potential reentry into foster care. The length of candidacy, there's no minimum or maximum length of time for a child to be considered a candidate for foster care. A state must justify, though, retaining a child in candidate status for longer than 6 months. Moving to the eligible services and programs. So this is where this provision narrows a good bit. The federal government, Congress, when passing this legislation, restricted the type of prevention services to three main categories. The federal government, HHS, is planning to issue guidance soon that goes into a little bit more detail about what examples of prevention services already exist throughout the country that meet and fall into these categories. But the statute itself makes clear that prevention services that can be used and can receive federal reimbursement have to tie in with mental health services or substance abuse prevention and treatment or in-home parent skill-based programs. So those are the three categories of prevention services. The prevention services have to fall within one of those three categories. Additional requirements or limitations is that prevention services can't be used for more than 12 months per candidate episode. And so that means that a child could potentially be considered a candidate on different occasions, but prevention services can't be used for more than 12 months for a particular, for one individual child, for one particular continuous period. Must meet certain evidence-based requirements. This is another area where the federal government will be issuing additional guidance soon. Must be trauma-informed. The services must be provided by a qualified clinician. That's for the first two. So the mental health services and the substance abuse prevention and treatment services have to be provided by a qualified clinician. That same restriction is not specified for the in-home parent skill-based programs. And then finally, the services have to be promising, supported, or well-supported programs. And this, again, is an area where the federal government will be issuing additional guidance and examples of programs that meet these criteria. In advance of providing that additional guidance, HHS did, the federal Department of Health and Human Services did request public comment on how to develop a clearinghouse of information about these services and provide additional guidance. And some of the themes, it's not public. There were many comment letters that were submitted, and the comment letters as a whole are not public, but some of the themes in the ones that we at the ABA, we did submit a letter, and also a number of other partners who we work with across the country had submitted letters, and some of the themes that emerged were an emphasis on peer advocates for children and peer advocates for parents, clarifying definitions of imminent risk of removal, and looking at, even though there are those three categories I mentioned, the mental health services, the substance abuse treatment services, and the in-home parent skill-based services and supports, a lot of the comments that came in really encouraged the government to look at examples of services that also touch on corollary issues, such as housing instability, domestic violence, and look at sort of services that recognize that often mental health and substance abuse have connections with other pressure points as well. HHS has explained that they're going to issue guidance rather than doing it through a regulation. They'll be issuing guidance in the form of an information memorandum, and there will be one organization that provides sort of that active clearinghouse of information about what constitutes these prevention services. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I want to make sure to keep an eye on the time. I'm not going to go into too much detail about the state requirements, so I will highlight on, this is slide number 11, that top bullet is a really important one to emphasize because this is similar to this being the first time that the federal government is providing funding for prevention services to prevent placement into foster care. There's also no Title IV-E income eligibility requirement. So as you all know, with children who are placed in foster care, in order for them to be eligible for federal reimbursement for the maintenance payment, they have to meet certain threshold requirements, or the family has to, with respect to income, and that does not exist for eligibility for prevention services. So theoretically, the prevention services are available to support federal reimbursement of state costs that are used to provide prevention services to families of any need. And so that's a significant piece of the legislation as well. And I will also just highlight the bullet that says maintenance of effort, because this one's an important one to note as well, that the federal government is reimbursing prevention services at a 50% rate. So the states that take this option of doing the prevention services reimbursement will be paying for 50% of the prevention services, and the federal government will be paying for 50%. There's a period at which, and I will highlight this in another slide, that shifts slightly, but the goal from the perspective of the legislation is that overall, by being able to use greater prevention services, it should lower costs and needs of entry into the system, and so overall it should create a benefit for states that are participating. And I will, on that note, also emphasize, which I think you probably already know on the phone call, but this prevention services provision of Family First is an option. It's not a requirement for states. They have the opportunity to choose to submit plans that would include proposals of what a state believes constitutes prevention services that are eligible for this kind of federal reimbursement, but there's no obligation to do so. So this is really an option for the states to partner with the federal government to try and draw down additional federal resources to prevent children's entry into child welfare, into foster care. Moving to the next category, which is on slide number 12. So this is a different provision. This is the family residential placement provision, and this is a definite attorney role. This, in sum, is the first time that 4E maintenance payments for children placed are available for a child who's placed with a parent who's in a licensed residential family-based treatment facility for substance abuse. So the idea here is that if a child can remain with their birth parent or legal custodian while that individual is undergoing substance abuse treatment, that may be the best interest of the child in order to maintain the bond. And previously, although the parent's treatment may be eligible for Medicaid, the child's placement in foster care would not have been able to be covered while in a family residential treatment facility with a parent. And so this now opens up the possibility that those maintenance payments can be used for keeping a child with their parent while the parent is in a specific kind of residential facility for substance abuse treatment. There are a number of these facilities around the country, but not a huge number. And so I think that this is an area where we will see substantial growth over time. When I've done this presentation in person, I always pause at this moment to ask in people's state and in people's individual jurisdictions within that state how many of these types of programs exist. And so I'd love to hear in follow-up feedback to this presentation within Wyoming if there are existing residential treatment facilities that are already being used that will benefit from this new component of the legislation opening up federal reimbursement for the maintenance payments of keeping children with their families. The requirements are that the placement recommendation, and this is very much an attorney role as well, placement recommendation for a child to stay with the parent and be in that kind of a residential family-based treatment facility for substance abuse, that recommendation has to be specified in the child's case plan prior to that placement decision. So a judge is going to see the case plan and the recommendation from the ADC caseworker, social worker, and from the attorney for the government and make a determination based on that recommendation. Children's advocates and parents' attorneys who are out there can also make that recommendation, but it has to be in the case plan and can certainly advocate for that in the case. The facility has to provide trauma-informed parenting skills-based training, parent education, and family counseling. Again, I'll go back to the themes to keep sort of anchoring a lot of substance, but everything seems to sort of tie back to these two, which is the goal here is, again, to put family first when it's possible, to keep children with their birth parent or existing legal custodian, and then the show me the money, which is that this opens up new federal resources of support for keeping children with their parents, even if they are in foster care. Reunification services. So this is a different provision, also a significant attorney role, and I think that the way that this will most likely play out from the attorney perspective is in, it'll be an important one to be aware of, certainly for attorneys who represent agencies and who represent government offices and decision makers, but also for advocates for children and advocates for parents to be aware of in individual cases. The summary of this provision is that it essentially makes a significant change to prior law by allowing Title IV-B reunification services, which have previously existed, and there has been federal funding for reunification services that used to be only available. They were time limited for 15 months, beginning on the date that the child entered foster care. And now these reunification services, based on changes from the Family First Prevention Services Act, these reunification services are not time limited while the child is in foster care, and they can be provided for up to 15 months after a child returns home in order to ensure the strength and stability of reunification. So I think in the sense of sort of direct practice and in individual cases, it's important to recognize that this should open up new opportunities for the potential of stabilizing a reunification, especially after a return home, by being able to provide ongoing services with federal support to draw down for ongoing services. Again, this really echoes back to the themes of Family First and an emphasis on the importance of reunification and of supporting reunification as a longer term, you know, that it is not just a goal that is reached at the end of the case, but that it is something that often needs a longer term investment as well. And again, the show me the money, which is that that there's actual dollars involved here to provide that support. This list on page 14 of the slides, this is not changed. This is already in existing law with respect to reunification services, but I think it's a really important list to highlight, again, because for attorneys in direct practice, these are the kinds of issues that you address all the time and hurdles that are addressed all the time. And so these reunification services can be used for these different types of activities, which are, again, also broader than the prevention services side. And so that's important to highlight as well, including assistance to address domestic violence, services designed to provide temporary child care and therapeutic services for families, including crisis nurseries, peer-to-peer mentoring and support groups for parents and primary caregivers, services and activities designed to facilitate access to and visitation of children by parents and siblings. So that's prior to reunification. And then a big one, which obviously comes up again and again in individual cases, is transportation to and from any of the services and activities described, which is an important one as well. Moving to slide number 15, another provision of the Family First Prevention Services Act that has relevance for the legal community are the kinship navigator programs. So within the legislation, this now opens up Title IV-E reimbursement funding for evidence-based kinship navigator programs. So those are programs that help relative caregivers, both within and outside of the child welfare system, to access services and supports to help meet the needs of the children they are raising and themselves, their own needs, including referrals to specialists, eligibility requirements to certain benefits, et cetera. So I think that for any cases that involve again, both in advance of entry into child welfare and after placement, these are services that would be designed to really facilitate and support kin caregivers. Number five on page 16 is model licensing standards. So this one goes back to that sort of overarching category of really helping states implement on the macro side of things. This provision requires the federal government to identify model licensing standards for family foster homes and it requires states to explain whether their standards are in accord with the federal model, and if not, why not. It requires the states to report on training of staff and use of waivers for non-safety licensing standards. So there are no specific standards that the states have to comply with, but it does require the federal government to issue standards and for states to examine the federal standards and to provide information about why their own licensing standards may vary from the federal model proposed. So the significant update on this is that the Department of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services did issue proposed standards in August of 2018, and they issued them through a notice and comment process requesting public comments. They received, I think, about 1,300 public comments by the deadline, and they're planning to issue their final standards shortly. The states will then have until April 1st to explain how their standards line up with the federal model licensing standards. I will say also the federal standards that were proposed in August are very closely aligned with some licensing standards that the ABA had developed a number of years ago in partnership with a couple of other national organizations, and those standards that we had developed and had deemed model licensing standards really derived from input directly from the states, looking at a wide swath of, looking at every state and looking at a wide swath of issues that were coming up for the states around licensing and some of the hurdles that states were trying to navigate, especially with respect to licensing relative caregivers. And so so we're interested in seeing what the federal government issues as its final material. But for anyone who's interested in that issue and would like to talk more, we have staff here at the ABA who'd be more than happy to field your questions as well. Moving to number 6 and on page 17, the interstate placement provisions. This provision of the Family First Prevention Services Act requires all states to use an electronic interstate case processing system by 2027 for the exchange of data and documents in order to expedite placements of children in foster, guardianship, or adoptive homes across state lines. On the next page, I've given a little bit of information about the implementation timeline. Really important, that first bullet, the federal reimbursement for children who are placed in residential family-based substance abuse treatment with a parent or caregiver, that reimbursement is available beginning of this fiscal year. So became there are now cases eligible for that as of October 1st, 2018. The second is federal reimbursement for Kinship Navigator programs, technically available October 1st, 2018 as well. There's a little bit of a caveat there because they have to be evidence-based, and we haven't gotten final policy guidance about what constitutes evidence-based kinship navigator programs, so that is forthcoming. And then finally, this federal reimbursement for the prevention services provisions that I talked about at the very beginning, that would become effective for any state that chooses to opt in for that and that would like to engage with the federal government in that opportunity. The federal reimbursement for those prevention services would become available, again, at that 50% rate starting October 1st of 2019. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, a lot of the important role of the legal community is not just understanding sort of how some of these provisions will play out in direct practice, but really being at the table at the outset within your states and within your community to talk about what are some of the implications of these different provisions and how they may play out. And I think lawyers, I am a lawyer and I love the law, so I think lawyers, I think very highly of lawyers and of sort of the approach of a legal community, judges, lawyers, court personnel, et cetera, and social workers who work closely on legal teams, I think that have a really important role to be reflecting right now on some of those questions and trying to help states navigate answers on the implementation side. So with respect to the prevention services provisions, I've listed here a number of the different questions that I think the legal community, and some of these are informed by questions that we're receiving, that the legal community is really wrestling with. One is, what form of review should exist for evaluating a decision to leave a child in his or her parents' care or with kin rather than entering into foster care? And I should highlight that one of the things that comes across in this question is in that prevention services component, children can be supported through prevention services by moving to being cared for by kin in addition to staying with their parents. Another question for the legal community, are there due process concerns? Because there's no petition that will have been filed, when should counsel be engaged for a child, for a parent, for an agency? I do think agency attorneys are going to have a particularly important role in the implementation side in this sense, because a lot of the decision-making will be coming from social workers and caseworkers who have to make those decisions about whether to use prevention services. And so I suspect that in many instances, the social worker will want to work closely with agency counsel to make sure that they're making the decision in a way that is informed by potential legal perspectives as well. What review should exist after prevention services? For example, if a child is with kin and the decision is safe reunification or custody or guardianship to kin or licensing of kin as a foster parent, who makes that recommendation and who's reviewing it? Because again, these are all decisions that are coming before there's a petition filed, and so there's no judicial review. What relationship might there be between reasonable efforts and prevention services if a child does enter foster care? And how would a judge evaluate that? And then what role can the legal community play advising states about the implications of this new federal legislation? The goal is to decrease total entries into foster care, but what risks do you see, right? There is a potential risk that in some ways this could play out as actually widening the number of children who interact with child welfare, even though the intention is to provide prevention services in a way that stabilizes the situation. It could have unintended consequences of actually increasing the sort of pool of candidates. And so a lot of that will be dependent on how these provisions are interpreted and applied in individual states and jurisdictions. In 10 years, where will we be and how will we get there? I'm going to skip over some of these other, these are with respect to the residential treatment placements, the reunification services, the kinship navigator programs, and the model standards, because I want to keep an eye on the time and I want to make sure that we do talk about the residential placement provisions, which also have a really important relevance for the legal community. So I'm moving to slide 22, which is section 2 of the presentation on residential placement. So these provisions, it's a couple of different provisions that all have an interconnected relevance, and the sort of overarching topic is placement that is not a foster family home. And there's a lot of significant attorney role. These will, of course, be situations where there is, you know, a child is in care, there is a judicial proceeding, and there are attorneys engaged on the case. So the provision in the statute provides that after 14 days in foster care, federal reimbursement for foster care payments will be limited only to supporting children who are either in a foster family home, right, so a licensed foster family home, a qualified residential treatment program, a setting that specializes in prenatal, postpartum, or parenting supports for youth, a supervised setting for youth who are ages 18 or over and are living independently, a setting with high-quality residential care and supportive services for children who have been or are at risk of being sex trafficking victims. And so again, just to highlight the themes here, as I talked about in the beginning of the presentation, a lot of the themes in these provisions on residential placements are on limiting the group home placements. A lot of the theme is on the importance of family and children's connectedness to either their own family or of family environment and a foster family home. And then again, the show me the money theme, which is really that by limiting federal reimbursement, the goal is to shift some of the way that foster care is structured. Moving to slide 23, the foster family home and how that's defined, licensed or approved by the state, adheres to reasonable and prudent parenting standards, provides care to 6 or fewer children in foster care. There are exceptions for parenting youth to remain with their child, keeping siblings together, keeping children with meaningful relationships with their family, or care for children with severe disabilities. Moving to slide 24, assessments. So there's a whole provision here about, this goes into more detail about the Qualified Residential Treatment Program, which I'll refer to as the QRTPs. So this is that after 14 days, a child who is determined to require an ongoing qualified residential treatment program needs to have a whole new set of assessments that confirm that that is the appropriate placement in order for federal reimbursement to continue beyond the 14 days. So an assessment of the child's placement in a QRTP has to happen within 30 days of the child's placement. The assessment has to be done by a qualified individual who is a trained professional or a licensed clinician who is not a state employee or is not affiliated with any placement setting. Now, there are some examples where that might be waived, and I think that's particularly relevant for a state like Wyoming, where there might be large distances between where a child might be placed and who is available to come and do that assessment. And so there may be exceptions granted as who can do the assessment. But in the majority of practice, the goal is that the assessment is done by someone who has no affiliation with a state agency and no affiliation with the placement setting itself. The tool must be age-appropriate, evidence-based, validated. This is another area where we're expecting guidance from the federal government. On page 25, the assessment must be conducted in conjunction with family. So this is another area where that theme of sort of family first and the importance of family having engagement with a child even once the child is in foster care really comes out. And I think for the direct practice side of things, this will be a really important role for attorneys who represent the government, attorneys who represent parents, and attorneys who represent children and youth, to really make sure that in situations that involve a child's placement in a QRTP, that this family engagement is happening as it's intended to in the statute. So in conjunction with the assessment, there has to be a family and permanency team meeting, and that has to include appropriate biological family members, relatives, and fictive kin, professionals who have helped the family, including teachers, medical or mental health providers who have treated the child, and clergy where appropriate. Children 14 and older can select the members of their permanency team, and if reunification is the goal, the parent from whom the child was removed must also have an opportunity to provide input on who comprises the child's permanency team. On page 26, additional factors for the assessment, and again, this is an area where there's a really specific role for the legal community and for attorneys and judges in particular. The assessment has to recognize that children should be placed with siblings unless there's a finding by the court that placement with siblings is contrary to a child's best interest. If the qualified residential treatment program is determined necessary as a placement for the child, a professional must document why the child's needs cannot be met in a family, and under no circumstances can a shortage of foster family homes be the acceptable reason for residential placement. So that's a very big provision to have in the letter of the law. If the assessment does not support a qualified residential treatment placement program placement, states have 30 days to then move the child to an eligible placement, or they risk losing federal reimbursement. The important thing to highlight here is, again, the states can use their own dollars to support ongoing placement, just they would not be eligible under that circumstance for federal reimbursement of the child's time in the QRTP. Ensuring the quality of residential treatment. These are requirements for what constitutes a qualified residential treatment program. I'm not going to go into all of these, but essentially sort of there's a stringent list of requirements for the QRTP itself. And then on page 28, monitoring, and this is a really important area of attorney role and goes to that sort of third category when I gave the initial categories of sort of what legal audience we're looking at from the perspective of the ABA. That third category of court hearings and judicial responsibilities, and this is really becomes particularly notable in this monitoring provision of the court has to review, according to the statutory text, the dependency court will have to review the QRTP assessment within 60 days of that child's placement. So the assessment has to happen within 30 days, and the court has to review it within 60 days. And then at every status and permanency hearing, the state has to provide ongoing evidence of the assessment and the needed continuation of that placement. The child welfare director has to approve any QRTP placement that lasts for a child for 12 consecutive or 18 cumulative months, or 6 months for any child in a QRTP who's under 13. Criminal background checks are required for all adults working in QRTPs and other group settings. And then on page 29, there's additional sort of checks and balances that, again, incorporate a legal role and an attorney role. There's protocols. The states, according to the statute, the new federal law, states have to establish protocols for ensuring that children in foster care are not inappropriately diagnosed with mental illnesses or other emotional or behavioral disorders, medically fragile conditions or developmental disabilities, and placed in settings that are not foster family homes as a result of that diagnosis. And then there's also a requirement that states have to report on the numbers of children in juvenile detention to ensure that children aren't being diverted from child welfare group home settings into juvenile detention facilities. Page 30 provides just a timeline of sort of how the decision and the assessments and the judicial review would occur in the situation of a placement in a qualified residential treatment program. And then 31 is really, again, sort of trying to think about, from the legal community perspective, what are the issues that are going to arise as this provision becomes effective. So what criteria should judges consider when reviewing and assessing group home placements? How should agency attorneys approach the requirement to submit evidence supporting the decision to maintain a residential treatment placement? How can attorneys incorporate family members in the treatment decision, including biological parents and kin? What role can attorneys and judges have shaping protocols to prevent inappropriate diagnoses if those don't already exist in Wyoming? And what other risks are there separate from diversion to juvenile justice? Are there concerns, for example, of an increased result of youth homelessness? The implementation timeline, and this connects in some way with the prevention services timeline, but the federal reimbursement for supporting a child's placement in a group home begins to become limited in that same October 1st of 2019 timeframe. However, states can extend that deadline by up to 2 years. So they can actually request a two-year delay for the limited federal reimbursement of group home placements. However, if the state chooses that two-year delay, they cannot then choose to start drawing down the prevention services for the same 2 years. So for any period of time that states extend the deadline, they will not be permitted to claim prevention funds. The court improvement programs throughout the country do have a training requirement for attorneys and judges to help implement these specific provisions. And then the final part in my remaining 3 minutes is the older youth provisions. And this, although there is not new funding attached to it, for states that do already extend or for states that are considering the extensions that existed under the Chafee Foster Care Independence Program, the Family First Prevention Services Act now provides states with the ability to extend those further, so to support a child who's been in the foster care system, to support them to the age of 23 rather than 21, extends eligibility for education and training vouchers to age 26, and allows HHS to redistribute unused TAFE funds, ensures that youth who have aged out have documentation that they were in foster care. Final slide is thank you for your interest and for your hopefully continued interest in engagement and wanting to help implement this new federal legislation. As I mentioned at the outset, there's a tremendous amount of detail in the federal legislation and a lot of opportunities for the legal community to be engaged in a lot of different areas. Please feel free to follow up with questions or requests for assistance. And the final thing is that the ABA every 2 years does a national conference for all professionals who work in children's law, and we'll be doing a Family First Act legal track at that conference this year between April 9th and 10th, just outside of D.C. And we'd love to see you there, so please encourage your colleagues to come as well. I think it'll be a really great opportunity to learn more and to see how this is already beginning to play out in different jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Prudence, and we're just almost out of time. I just wanted to remind listeners that our next Blog Talk Radio will occur on December 13th. The title of that is called Dealing with Difficult People. It'll be presented by Lisa Finke, an attorney in Gillette, so we'd encourage you to tune into that one. Again, thank you, Prudence, and I just really appreciate you providing your contact information if we have any follow-up questions. Thank you again, and have a wonderful day.
Great. Thanks so much. Take care.